On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Use of Risk Assessment and Management of Contaminated Sites. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Risk Assessment Resources Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC Risk Assessment Resources Team. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the ITRC document, Use of Risk Assessment and Management of Contaminated Sites, the RISC-2 document. And we're going to take you to a link at the end of the training class where you can download this document, as well as the RISC-1 document, the first document from the ITRC RISC team. We'll also make available the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In the downloaded version of the presentation, we have an additional notes section that has more details. And again, at the end of the class, we're going to take you to a link where you can download both the document and the presentation used during today's class. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. If you move to slide 2, if you're using CLUIN, it's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate. And most often you use the third button, the single right arrow, to move forward through the presentation. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. For our phone line participants, we have started out with all lines muted, but we'll remind you how to unmute during the question and answer break so that you can ask questions. For our simulcast audience, you're welcome to ask questions. You can select that question mark button at the top of the slide, type in your question, and we'll get to as many as we can during the question and answer break. Anyone is welcome to use that question mark button throughout today's presentation. As we go through today's presentation, each of you are in control of which slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors will say the slide numbers as we go through the presentation. On the last slide, we have a link to our feedback form, and we do ask that everyone on the call today take just a few minutes at the end of the class to fill out the feedback form. We do use that information, and really appreciate your time to give us your feedback. Today's event is being recorded, and we offer archives of past ITRC classes, and I've listed the link to the archives on this slide. On slide 3, this is our disclaimer and copyright that we include in all ITRC training presentations, and ask that you please read over the slide. In short, it says we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide 4, this is some information about ITRC. So if you're new to ITRC, I encourage you to go to the website, learn more about how you can become more involved. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. It's overall a network that's led by state regulators, includes federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. This diverse group works together and addresses a wide variety of topics that may be related to a technology or type of site. And they communicate their results through the products, the technical and regulatory guidance documents, as well as internet-based and classroom training. On slide 5, you can see examples of topics that ITRC has recently addressed. These are the topics that in 2011 we offer training classes. We continue to offer popular courses from previous years, as well as develop new courses each year. We also list our 2-day classroom training, Vapor Intrusion Pathway and LNAPLS. Boat registration is open for both of those 2-day classroom trainings. More information is available on the ITRC website. You can follow the links to read more about the classes and to register. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. All instructors were members of the ITRC Risk Assessment Resources Team. That team was led by Steve Dizio from the California Department of Toxic Substance Control and Brian Espy from the Alabama Department of Environmental Management. Bennett Kotler currently lives in New Orleans. Previously, he was a branch supervisor of the Nevada Petroleum Fund located in Carson City. He provided technical, regulatory, and fiscal oversight on remediation cases ranging from residential heating oil tanks to a site used to test engines for the space shuttle program. Marty Brewer works for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Contaminant Site Program as a technical lead in the areas of human health and ecological risk assessment in Anchorage, Alaska. Janine Hanley is a senior risk assessor at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality in Phoenix. She conducts risk-based evaluation of UST, mining, agriculture, solid waste and hazardous waste sites, as well as development of risk-based standards. Usually we have Kurt Franzen on the call. He's from Windsor, Connecticut, and is having flooding issues right now, so he's not available to join us. Special thanks to Bennett for filling in. On slide 7, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Bennett Kotler from New Orleans. Bennett?
Thanks very much, Juliana. The Risk Resources team, with representatives from a variety of state and U.S. federal agencies, consulting firms, academic institutions, as well as public stakeholders, has published two documents. On the left side of slide 7, you can see an image of the cover from the 2005 document, a white paper entitled Examination of Risk-Based Screening Values and Approaches of Selected States Documents. The team previously offered a companion introductory internet-based training program that's currently archived at the CLUIN program. Hopefully you've had a chance to review that document or participate in that internet-based training course. And that internet training course covered basic risk assessment concepts, a survey of the screening values that different states use, and two of the five actual case studies that appear in the 2008 document that'll be the basis of today's presentation. And in 2008, that document that was published was an overview document entitled Use of Risk Assessment in Management of Contaminated Sites. So we went from risk assessment and the use of screening values to now the use and risk assessment in management of sites. Now what we'll do is we'll delve into risk management and how all of risk assessment and soil screening values are used. And in this training, we presume that you have an advanced understanding of risk assessment. We're really not going to spend time on basic concepts. So hopefully you're up to speed. If not, then maybe you can take a step back and start out with that other document and catch up to us with an archived one. An archive of that presentation. But if you're all ready to go, then let's turn to slide 8. And our purpose today is to provide you highlights of the Risk Assessment Resources Team Overview document, Use of Risk Assessment in Management of Contaminated Sites. The significance of the overview document is that we try to provide you a snapshot view of risk management decision-making and how risk assessment is folded into that decision-making. Our study reflects upon the sources of variability in risk assessment, and it's the first time that we know of that there's a side-by-side comparison of the principles and practices which lead to the variation of different organizations, which drives everyone crazy of why are different decisions being made from agency to agency and case to case. So hopefully you'll see some of that illustrated for you. On slide 9, because of the nature of risk assessment and risk management, it's always context-bound. It begins in a different place. It ends in a different place by solving different risk needs. Maybe the end is for a residential concern. Maybe the end is for an industrial concern. So this presentation is not a presentation of a one-size-fits-all tech reg document. That may be the more familiar training program to you, which you may have participated in from the ITRC. Risk assessment and its use in risk management, and frankly a lot of science, makes me think of Alice in Wonderland, the children's novel written by Lewis Carroll in 1865. And if you haven't read it or seen the movie as of late, it tells the story of a girl named Alice who falls down a rabbit hole into a fantasy world populated by peculiar creatures. And in one part, Alice meets a Cheshire cat and asks, "Would you tell me, please, which way I ought to go from here?" And the cat answers, "Well, that depends a good deal on where you want to get to." Because risk management is so context-bound and so linked to the goal, the answer you intend to achieve, and of course you're starting out in different places, we cannot train you which way to go. We can't train you in any one approach to risk management because it very much depends on where you and the responsible party and the manager and the regulator and the other stakeholders on where you all want to get to. On slide 10, we hope to reveal the current state of the practice of using risk assessment and risk management by offering these lessons learned. And this makes me think of the climax of the movie The Wizard of Oz, in which Toto, Dorothy's dog, pulls aside the curtain to reveal the identity of the Wizard of Oz. And in this photo, you can see the disappointment on the face of Dorothy and the other characters because they learn that the wizard is simply an ordinary person. So we'd like you to think of us as Toto pulling aside the curtain that shrouds this very mysterious risk management process so that you may improve your risk assessment and your risk management. On slide 11, okay, as I'll detail in module 4, the team reviewed the risk assessment process, looking both retrospectively at actual case studies and then looking prospectively, looking forward at hypothetical cases. We use both of these techniques to make key findings on how these practices were implemented in the case studies and how they impacted the management decision. We developed perspectives, and then we developed recommendations for a process that would improve risk management. The proposed improved process is really no more difficult than the classical risk assessment, risk management process, and it can be simply summed up as in the box in the lower portion of the slide. And what we recommend is that you know the players, those individuals who can directly or indirectly impact the risk management decision. You communicate, which is key to developing a common framework, which in the next step everyone will agree upon the common framework, and you will iterate. You will repeat this process to achieve the best possible risk assessment, risk management decision possible so that everybody is on board as much as possible during the life cycle of your project. So please look for these elements throughout today's class. Slide 12. This is not a tools training class, but hopefully it starts a dialogue for you to consider the sources of variation in the risk assessment process that is incorporated into the ultimate risk management decision. And together what we're going to do is review the risk assessment and risk management practices from across the United States. And we'll do that to determine why risk assessment and risk management practices are so variable. We'll teach you what to look for to navigate the variation, and we will give you ways to improve the use of risk assessment and risk management decision making as you work from one site to the next. On slide 13, you can see an overview of today's training. As I said before, today's training is a summary of the Risk Assessment Resources Team Overview Document, Use of Risk Assessment and Management of Contaminated Sites. We will refer to that document, and if things go quickly, if you miss something, you can always refer to that document, which includes more detail than we can possibly cover today during this 2.25-hour program. This effort, again, builds upon the team's previous work looking at the development of risk assessment soil screening levels and trying to figure out where those numbers came from. Well, in the first module, Marty Brewer of Alaska DEC will introduce some of the issues commonly encountered in the risk assessment process and how they're addressed. In the second module, I will provide a summary of a retrospective study of real sites and real data to evaluate what was done. In Module 3, Janine Hanley of Arizona DEQ will turn that around and evaluate hypothetical sites to evaluate how risk assessments would be used in risk management. And in Module 4, I'll try to summarize things, put them all the various perspectives and findings together, and re-summarize how they play a role in the risk assessment, risk management process, and provide recommendations. So with that, I would like to turn the program over to Marty Brewer of Alaska DEC.
Thanks, Bennett. Have you turn to slide 14 and introduce you to the Module 1, Theory and Practice of Risk Assessment. And In this module, I just want to summarize some of the issues that the team examined in our evaluation of the theory and the current practice of risk assessment. What we ultimately found is that although the basic theory of is relatively well understood, the actual practice varies and somewhat wide-ranging. In this module, I'm going to present several of the issues that we explored, but by no means a comprehensive list. But these are just some of the issues that we encounter that can result in some significant variation in the practice of risk assessment. And these are based on our observations and our professional experience and are not identical to those variations that are discussed in the case studies, but we felt important that we discuss them in this module. Turning to slide 15, let's step back a moment and just take a look at why and how risk assessments are used in the management of contaminated sites. This slide shows the continuum of where risk assessment is used in managing risks at hazardous waste sites. And as we demonstrated in our last risk teams endeavor, soil screening levels vary. However, how these screening levels are used in risk assessment also varies. And that's really where we're going to get to in this exercise. We want to explore how the exposure concentration is developed and how that's compared to the soil screening level. And by looking at this figure, it's clear that not all sites need the same level of remediation or management. It's really the magnitude type and the number of contaminants that would dictate the level of remediation or management that's warranted. Turning to slide 16, what I hope you get out of this module is some insight into the various sources of variability in risk assessment and management processes used by several states. And we do this by showing you some survey results that we conducted. And to our knowledge, this was the first side-by-side comparison of how various risk assessment approaches or criteria are applied throughout the process of screening, characterization, and remediation of contaminated sites. So on slide 17, why do we do risk assessments? What's the purpose of this? Ultimately, risk assessment answers the question of whether or not there's a problem that warrants some sort of protective action or remediation. And in doing so, it provides the scientific and legally defensible support to base risk-based management decisions upon. Basically, it supports risk-based cleanup. In doing so, there's a cost effectiveness to doing risk assessments because you're setting site-specific cleanup goals instead of cleaning up to background or some screening levels or cleaning up to non-detects. And it also allows you to focus your actions on the risk drivers and get the most bang for your buck. But finally, it also allows you to evaluate exposure pathways whereby you might restrict certain activities and avoid exposure while allowing the reuse of a site. So if a residential use is not practicable, you might evaluate other exposure scenarios and have a reuse of that site. So turning to slide 18, so we kind of talked about the purpose of risk assessment. Now we get to the risk management decision-making process. And risk managers not only have to evaluate the risks to the receptor population, but also consider other issues. Issues like social and political issues involved in the site or technology. And really taking into account who the players are and what do they value. They also have to consider regulatory approval of the action or any kind of regulatory requirements for addressing the risks. And finally, they have to all consider the cost and feasibility of implementing a specific alternative, the cost-benefit consideration, if you will. So on slide 19, I'll take you to a a rather simplistic figure of risk characterization and how we integrate information. And although it looks rather simple, there's a lot of sources of variability within this process. Everything from source identification, where you have sampling variations, what type of sampling are you going to do? Are you going to do compositing or discrete field sampling screening versus fixed lab sampling? To where the contaminants go, the fate and transport, and modeling, what models are you going to use to demonstrate where the contaminants are going? What kind of receptors are you evaluating? Are you evaluating any sensitive populations that warrant special consideration? Also, the temporal consideration of the exposure. Are we looking at a current exposure scenario? Are we looking at the future use of the site? And then also the dose, or how much are the receptors being exposed to? Are the contaminants bioavailable? So how much are they actually, how much dose are they getting to calculate the risks? And finally, the toxicology consideration. What toxicity values are being used? And how do you how do you account for cumulative effects of multiple contaminants? So although this figure looks rather simple, I mean, there's a lot of different areas where you can have some sources of variability come in and ultimately change the risk assessment outcome. So on slide 20, we'll get to some of the issues that we, the risk team, collaborated on and what we consider were some of the most important issues from our own experiences and perspectives. And we'll explore several here and in the overview document to uncover the variability in the practices used in risk assessments. And mind you, this is not a comprehensive list by no means, but these were some of the we wanted to highlight. And I would like to point out that the first three issues, that of background and hotspots and use of tiered approaches, those are more data or technical considerations. Whereas the last one, stakeholder and end user perspectives, raises kind of the social political issue and then kind of the values consideration. And getting back to the idea that risk assessment is this fact-driven exercise, but stakeholder and end-user values should certainly be considered in the risk assessment inputs to achieve the common goal. So jumping to slide 21, we'll go into our first data issue that the team explored. And I'll refer you to section 3.3, table 3.3 of the overview document, where you'll find the survey results. But what we did was we conducted a survey of the states to ask them how they address background in risk assessment. And we asked a series of questions, specific questions, where we got responses. And pretty surprisingly, when we asked the question of whether or not your state has a formal guidance on the use of background in risk assessments, we found that not all states do have specific guidance. But interestingly enough, all states surveyed say they do allow for the evaluation of background and risk assessment. So it's a pretty significant finding that, you know, so many states are allowing for the use of background in risk assessment, but yet they don't have specific guidance on how you derive that number. We also asked questions about sampling for background. How do you sample for it? And here again, the survey responses varied from everything from one sample is good enough to 4 to 10 to whatever is deemed adequate. So far as what types of samples, some prefer discrete sampling, others composite, and a few states are now using a multi-incremental sample approach for determining background. But ultimately what we found is that unless specific requirements were spelt out, that best professional judgment is allowed. We also asked the question, what do you do if your background levels exceed risk-based health criteria? Can you exclude that chemical from concern for remediation? And some states said yes, but you still have to consider it in the cumulative risk. Moving to slide 22, the second data or technical issue that we explored was that of hotspots. And here again, we conducted a survey, and I'll refer you to section 321 of the overview document, table 32, the hotspot table, for survey responses. But here again, we asked specific questions about, does your state have a formal definition of what a hotspot is? And only three of the 20 states said yes, they have a formal definition. And as can be seen in Table 3.2, by and large, the characteristics and written definitions of hotspots fall into two categories, non-quantifiable and precisely numerical. However, since neither area or elevated are specified, the definition may not lead to the same answers as the question of whether or not there's a hotspot if you ask several people that question. Of the numerical criteria, for instance, either there was it's not specified or it varied from a cleanup level to a screening level to some acceptable risk level to evaluate the site average to the surrounding area. So far as what area or volume represents a hotspot, it could be anything from a sample as a hotspot to some area as defined by exceeding a cleanup level to some mass-based determination. We also asked the question about how do you sample hotspots, and here again, sampling varied from simple random to directed to judgmental, systematic random, or best professional judgment. But one thing to keep in mind is that oftentimes hotspots are sampled in a focused or biased manner to determine the magnitude and extent of contamination. But yet this data is then used for risk assessment. And so it begs the question to ask, is this to say that a hotspot is the exposure area to be considered for the risk assessment? And oftentimes that is the case. On slide 23, I'll take you to the third data or technical issue that we explored, and that's of the use of tiers. And I'll refer you to section 3.4 of the overview document for the discussion of the use of tiered approaches in risk-based investigation or remediation. As you may be aware, the idea of using tiers to appropriately allocate the amount of effort or resources spent on an investigation is based on the apparent significance or complexity of the site. So oftentimes, a simple site may warrant only a Tier 1 assessment where you have a simple lookup table. On the other hand, a more complicated site may need a more sophisticated analysis. Here again, we also asked questions of how tiered systems approaches were used by the states, and ultimately found that the feds use a two-tiered type system of screening and risk assessment, whereas the states, the majority of them use a three-tiered approach, sharing a lot of the common elements but slightly different versions, whereas the tier one is the use of the simple lookup table. It's really quick and dirty. It requires little effort, but you have a great deal of uncertainty, and therefore you have to be more conservative in your risk management options. Tier two being a little bit more refined, having some site-specific calculations, but still using a lot of defaults. And so you still have to be somewhat conservative in risk management decisions for those sites. And the Tier 3 is where you have a more formal site-specific risk assessment. And it's really the most resource-intensive effort, requiring the most effort. But you also get a lot more certainty in the risk estimate and therefore allows you to have a lot more finite risk management options available to you. But ultimately what we found was that the tiers were not always clearly defined by the states. Some states do have specific guidance on the use of their tiered systems, but not all of them do. But ultimately that the more complex the assessment, the more issues there are to consider. Here again, what freight and transport modeling is going to be accepted and utilized. What is your point or area that must comply with your tier standard? How's your exposure point concentration determined? Do you use a maximum or upper confidence level? How much data do you need and how good does it need to be to support the determinant of your tier 2, 3 standard? And at what point, if at all, is the cost of the collection of the data in support of the cost to conduct the tier 2 or 3 evaluation considered? So what's that cost-benefit consideration? But ultimately, the success of any tiered approach certainly demands that all the players have to be on board and know where they want to go in order to determine how best to get there. On slide 24, we finally get to the value consideration that we considered. And this is the social and political issues and stakeholder participation. And I'll refer you to Chapter 6, where we explored the various insiders' perspectives on the use of risk assessment and risk management. When I say stakeholders and insiders, I'm referring to the regulators, the stakeholders, the end users, the public. So there's a lot of different participants' values that are considered. And we discussed those in Chapter 6 a little bit more in depth. But ultimately, we tried to get to what the stakeholders were considering was important. What did they value? And getting back to this value consideration to bridge that fact-value gap. Recalling that risk assessment is this fact-driven exercise, but it's the stakeholders' values that should be considered in the risk assessment inputs to achieve that common goal. The team certainly concurred on the importance of risk communication, realizing that better and more refined risk management decisions can be made with early and often stakeholder involvement and participation, which results in more effective risk communications because everyone is on board throughout the process instead of trying to bring everybody up to speed and sway them to your side at the end. It's much easier to have them on board throughout the process so everybody gets to the same place at the same time. We also realized the importance of the temporal consideration of stakeholders' perspectives. The current versus future consideration, if you will. And as you'll see in the case studies later on, it makes a huge difference if you're considering a future residential development of a contaminated site as opposed to a contaminated site that someone is already living on. Asking that question of what risk level are you willing to accept and at what cost, the temporal consideration makes a huge impact. So on slide 25, what I hope to drive home here is that variation exists in how risk assessment is carried out by different entities is illustrated in our surveys and team discussions in this module. Why that is, who knows? It could be social, political, regulatory, technological, or even simple economics. But the variation exists as well as others. And these sources of variability can lead to significantly different management decisions as you're going to see in the following case studies. So how do you navigate this process if you realize that there's so many sources of variability in the risk assessment and coming up with that risk number? Well, it ultimately necessitates this balancing act of all the players, the regulators, stakeholders, and end users to achieve that common goal, and really bridging that fact-value gap. So with that, I'm going to turn back over to Bennett for Module 2.
I'm going to present the highlights of 3 out of 5 case studies of actual remediation cases. And these are from the Risk Assessment Resources Team Overview document, Use of Risk Assessment in Management of Contaminated Sites. We have limited time in this presentation, so I can only present three case studies. However, there's a PowerPoint presentation compiling all five case studies that can be accessed by following our Links to Additional Resources page at the CLUIN website. And of course, you can read the overview document, which provides a discussion of these three, as well as the two additional cases of actual sites that were evaluated. On slide 27, in this module, we'll take a retrospective look at three actual case studies and look at what was done. I'd also like you to look for the issues that Marty identified as important in Module 1. And the way I see it, risk assessment and risk management practices are a balancing act. They're a balancing act between the players, the stakeholders. They're a balancing act between the communication that takes place, the data that are available, the iteration that takes place, and then the variation. If you look at it another way on slide 28, there's this balancing act of what is acceptable among the amount of time, the amount of money, the players, and the amount of cleanup that's done versus the amount of certainty, or if you like, uncertainty, that is acceptable, and the amount of data analysis is done. For instance, if the regulator or perhaps the responsible party wants more certainty, well, that's fine, but that's going to take more time to reduce that uncertainty. On the other hand, if the responsible party wants less data analysis, or interestingly, maybe the regulators don't need as much data analysis, well, they are going to make you do more cleanup. They're going to make you project managers, manage things differently based on, again, this set of considerations that may not be solely technical. Or let's put it this way, there's some valuation even of the science-driven management approach. So the variation results from a different balancing act of the considerations and interactions among the players. So no two risk management approaches are the same. And as I stated in the introduction, we cannot train you in which way to go because we don't know on where you and this entire team of stakeholders and players, which way you want to get to. On slide 29, I'm going to start telling you about how the case studies were done. What we did was the risk team retrospectively evaluated cleanups at actual sites with standardized data collection forms, and that allowed a consistent means to assemble and compare data from one site to the next. In Appendix B of the Risk Assessment Resources Team Overview document, you can see the completed forms for each case study, and you can see that the information collected included information about the site background, the sampling and data use, and risk-related information. What we decided to do was focus on simple sites, and the reason for that was to display the differences in the approaches rather than get bogged down in the complexities of the sites. And what we mean by a simple site is that they have mostly soil ingestion, they have one or a few chemicals, and only shallow contamination. Nonetheless, all the sites were fully characterized to rule out exposure to groundwater contamination. And I'd like to point out one more thing to you before we start looking at these case studies. The retrospective analysis was not an effort to second guess or to fix the risk assessments and risk management decision making, which we might look at and think, well, that wasn't right. That wasn't the best way to get that done. I know a lot of you will start thinking that midway through this module and that you'll know how to fix it, or you know how to properly conducted the project management at the site. but I encourage you to remain focused on this module as we did during our study on understanding the sources of the variation that affected these cases, and ultimately they may affect your case too. On slide 30, you can see the five case studies that were reviewed in the document, Use of Risk Assessment and Management of Contaminated Sites. From west to east, the sites were an Army base in Evergreen, Washington, near Tacoma, Washington, a former fruit orchard in Whitebridge, California, a leaking underground storage tank site, a Lust site in Wisconsin, a formerly used defense site in Spring Valley, D.C., and a former mercury-based manufacturer on Grand Street in Hoboken, New Jersey. On slide 31, you can see, in the interest of time, I'm only going to review three of these sites, although I will note all five sites when I make some conclusions at the end of this module. And the ones I'm going to look at are the former fruit orchard, the Lust site in Wisconsin, and the former mercury-based manufacturer. And again, there is that ITRC PowerPoint presentation with the supplement today's training with slides describing all five of the case studies. So let's look at the very first one. We turn to slide 32. You can see the Whitebridge, California former commercial orchard. It had operated from the 1930s to the 1980s, at which time it was proposed for residential development. There were eight contaminants of possible concern, and the developer proposed a management criterion with a goal of minimal soil removal. The reason for that was to comply with a local ordinance requiring 2 feet of topsoil above septic systems. Well, right from the start of this project, we have good and clear communication of what one of the interests is of the stakeholder. Arguably, that shouldn't be a problem. We now have this goal, this challenge to meet. However, we're going to have to balance the limited excavation, limited remediation of a desire of the developer with higher data quality, higher data analysis, and certainty that what we do not excavate, what we do not remediate, will not pose an unacceptable excess risk. So let's see how this challenge was met. On slide 33, there were three tiers of risk assessment performed at the site, and this slide summarizes the results of three tiers of effort, so it's a tremendous amount of information boiled down to a single figure. And what I do present, I only present the incremental lifetime cancer risk for a child resident. There were additional receptors, including adults and construction workers, and additional endpoints. But just focusing on this one, I want you to watch what happens to the excess cancer risk at the site. On the left side of the figure, you can see there's a bar that says Tier 1 screening, and that was screening that was done of the entire site. And the result of that was that the excess cancer risk was determined to be 3 times 10 to the minus 4. This was obtained with California EPA's preliminary endangerment assessment guidance, which uses screening with conservative default assumption from US EPA risk assessment guidance equation. Among the conservative assumptions include that the maximum concentration of each contaminant of concern is uniformly distributed across the entire site. Well, that's not realistic, but it sure is conservative for an initial screening whereby we're going to use limited information. So the conclusion from this was that certain contaminants of concern may pose a risk to human health, and further evaluation is warranted. And so a Tier 2 assessment was done. And again, this is just following on the kind of thing that Marty indicated in the introductory module. So if you look in the middle of the slide, you can see that there was a Tier 2 assessment done, and that, rather than using default assumptions, was using site-specific data. It also broke the entire site into two, into the orchard where the pesticides were applied and a remote fill area where the chemical stocks were used, and that was likely to have higher contamination. You can see, again, the orchard in blue, and the remote fill is hatched in red. And you can see that the risk in the orchard was somewhat lower. It was 9 times 10 to the minus 5, and in the remote fill area, it remained as high as the initial screening at 3 times 10 to the minus 4. So the conclusion is, well, it appears that there is less risk in the orchard. However, there may be a risk to human health in both areas. So, given these results, that preliminary and site-specific risk assessment both show the potential for risk, what's the next course of action? You project managers, you could have taken this project in a different way and say, well, could we please start excavating? Could we please get the shovels in the ground? Some managers have that predisposition. They just want to remediate. However, the responsible party previously communicated their interest, and they said it was less desirable to start remediating. So, the option that was pursued was further evaluation, and you can see that on the right side of the slide, where a probabilistic risk assessment was done of both the orchard and the remote fill area, doing them separately. It also included a bioavailability evaluation. And what was found by this additional level of analysis was that the risk in the orchard was ruled out and found to be manageable. It was found to be 2 times 10 to the minus 6. In the remote fill area, it was still found to potentially be unacceptably high at 1 times 10 to the minus 5. So the conclusion to this last assessment is that part of the risk was ruled out from the site. The corrective action and remediation effort was now focused on a subset of the entire site. And although this isn't shown, the number of contaminants of concern was reduced, and it was found that arsenic was the risk driver. So, therefore, development of a risk-based cleanup level for arsenic in the remote fill area was warranted. On slide 34, I'd like to summarize some things that we saw by taking a look at that case study. And what we saw was a balance between the developer's goal of minimal soil removal and the need for more rigorous risk analysis. This also illustrates the iterative approach noted in the introduction. They went through three tiers of risk assessment. The first two indicated potential for risk. The last one reduced the area of concern and the contaminants of concern. We saw clear communication of goals. And as an end note, the contaminated soil was managed in an innovative way. It was used for roadway fill. And there was an on-site deed restricted containment cell that the developer included as part of the development project. So, this is the Cadillac of our studies. I'd now like to move on to slide 35, and you can choose whether it's a Yugo or the opposite of a really well-done project. But this is also a reality check for the way that cases and decision-making are managed. On slide 35, you can see that leaking underground storage tank cleanup in Wisconsin. It was an operating gasoline station with a release from a tank system that was being replaced. And the release was discovered during replacement of the tank system. And it was found that benzene was the primary contaminant of concern with 13 milligrams per kilogram in soil. On slide 36, in contrast to the previous case study where a single tier was used to, a single tier was used to screen a single benzene hotspot, so there was only a single data point. That single benzene concentration exceeded the state of Wisconsin's direct contact screening value. It was plugged into a U.S. EPA soil screening guidance calculator, and the inhalation and ingestion concentrations were both exceeded from that calculator. The remedial outcome was there was this data point that they couldn't get rid of, and they only had one of them, but that single hot spot beneath an existing dispenser at a commercial site was closed in place with a barrier to prevent direct contact human exposure. A detailed closure letter with land use limitation was required. It's a less burdensome form of a deed restriction. So the equivalent of a deed restriction was placed on the site. On slide 37, I'd like to discuss some of the points from this case, and you know that's all there is for us to look at. And we can already see that in some ways this is a negative control, and it illustrated what happens when small LUST sites, those again leaking underground storage tank sites, they use soil sample that's focused on the extent or magnitude of contamination rather than using systematic sampling to support risk assessment. They collected the wrong data. Overall, what happens at a lot of LUST sites is the responsible party's desire to close a site often is the trigger for remediation or closure plans. It's kind of like a backwards investigation. So the LUST sites tend to be reactive risk assessments, and a lot of the risk management decisions are made by the case officer. So what we saw on this site was a balancing act of this LUST site with soil data inappropriate for risk analysis and the desire for case closure. And so they had to be overly conservative, and a single hotspot was allowed to drive the management of the site. So this illustrates the need for further development of practical risk management decision-making processes for petroleum contamination. When the risk resources team discussed this, the members were split as to what we should say about conducting risk assessment at LUST sites. Some said LUST sites are unique, and a state representative from Florida said, nope, you know, Florida has the resources and uses Rebecca, risk-based corrective action. The Wisconsin regulator said, well, it's not cost-effective to perform the full-blown risk assessment. It may be more cost-effective to get that institutional control placed on the site rather than do the risk assessment. So this is an interesting reality check, and this is a very good lesson for us to learn as to what's actually taking place on particular projects. I'd like to conclude with this last case study. In this particular one, there was a mercury gas lamp and connector switch manufacturer for over 50 years that was located on Grand Street in New Jersey. And it was run by the Cooper Hewitt Company. And Mr. Cooper Hewitt had developed mercury gas lights. The older ones of you listening to this might remember these green lights that went up and down roads. And when critics at the time that Mr. Cooper Hewitt was alive complained about this green-colored light making people look like, quote-unquote, bloodless corpses, Mr. Cooper Hewitt had to respond that the economy of operation will much more than compensate for the somewhat unnatural color given to illuminated objects. So I'll let you decide bloodless corpses or somewhat unnatural color. Nonetheless, Mr. Cooper Hewitt was lucrative, and if you ever visit New York City, you can see his Museum of Design, founded by his three granddaughters, and there's the Cooper Union College down in Greenwich Village. On slide 39, we fast forward to the conversion of this manufacturing building to 16 residential studios from 1993 to 1995. 15 of 16 conversions were complete prior to the identification of site-wide mercury contamination, which was found in the flooring and in the porous wood. It was found in the brick. It was found in the tar. Legend has it that a resident was cooking and mercury dripped onto the stove. So the residents were immediately relocated in 1996, and urine analysis found 20 residents, including 5 children, had mercury levels of concern for neuro and hepatotoxicity. So the balancing consideration for this site is that it was immediately a Superfund site, whereby the U.S. EPA takes the lead rather than New Jersey DEP. Otherwise, for that, it was a standard risk assessment. On slide 40, the interesting thing about this case is that there were two regulatory agencies. Otherwise, it was a conventional risk assessment. U.S. EPA Region 2 took the lead because the site was categorized as a Superfund site, and that's true of all Superfund sites in New Jersey. Interestingly, New Jersey tends to be a conservative state when it comes to risk assessment because of its legacy of a large number of industrial sites. And you can see in this table, the colored boxes with red indicate the decisions that were used in this cleanup. And as you can see, there was a mixture of two cleanup criteria. So this explains the variation that you see at this particular site, which was different than a typical project you would find in New Jersey, and different than a project that US EPA might manage. It was a hybrid of the two. I'd also just point out one thing on this. I point out the risk range for carcinogens. Because there was elemental mercury at this particular site, it was not evaluated. But this does interestingly point out that US EPA Region 2 would accept a range of carcinogenic excess risk, whereas New Jersey DEP would not have. If you move on to slide 41, you can see the iterative approach that was used in this particular site. Surficial soil cleanup goals were established in 2003. Which was intended to be protective of exposure from both inhalation and soil ingestion. And then later on, in 2004, a subsurface saturated soil cleanup goal was established to be protective of utility workers who might get higher exposure levels than residents. So again, the project is managed step by step. Numbers are not established immediately. Well, because the goals were unable to be met, the building was torn down, and that was the remedial approach on this site. On slide 42, I'd like to quickly summarize what we saw from this case, and that was a balancing between two regulatory authorities. The Superfund site led to US EPA taking the lead, even though it was located in New Jersey. The acute hazard to the existing residents made screening moot. There's no point. They were actually being exposed. So you could not just use your cookbook process for how to do risk assessment. The remediation of the site was demolition because the indoor air objective couldn't be achieved. And interestingly, a final note is, at the time we were putting together this presentation, redevelopment was being planned. And you know what? If the redevelopment did not happen, I bet you it had more to do with the economic meltdown in the United States than it had to do with any risk assessment issues or any science-based reasons for why it shouldn't have proceeded. Slide 43. I'm going to summarize information from this module, and I'm also going to include some information about the last two sites so that we get a total of 5 sites that you can see in the overview document, Use of Risk Assessment in Management of Contaminated Sites. And again, they're all compiled into one PowerPoint presentation. Looking down the columns of information, you can see the variation among the sites that we found as part of our case studies. You can see that the contaminants of concern were different, and in some cases, where, say, at the very bottom, arsenic was the contaminant of concern at a site we didn't cover, Spring Valley, just outside of Washington, D.C., with arsenic, background is an issue. So that needs to be measured. For other sites, background considerations are not a consideration. You can see that the acres of the sites varied from large fruit orchard that we looked at, 184-acre site, to, again, down to the very bottom, you see these single-family quarter-acre size units. The former land uses varied, and interestingly, the future land uses varied, where, if you take a look, note that in two sites, they were currently occupied by residents. So when we talk about who are the players, who are the stakeholders, who do you need to get on board, yeah, it's going to include those residents that are on top of your cleanup site. Slide 44. I'd like you to think back to Marty's slides in her discussion of the use of tiers in Module 1. What this slide shows you are the number of tiers that we used in the various cases. At the very top, that Whitebridge, California fruit orchard, we saw three tiers, preliminary, deterministic, and probabilistic risk assessment. Honestly, the developer must have had money, and it was in California, and California had the brains and the regulatory appetite to do this. The Lust site we looked at, they didn't do this. They only had one tier. And in the Grant Street, they used two tiers. I do want to point something out. You know, it's not just brains and money that might limit why you might choose to only use one tier. Take a look at the Evergreen Washington site, one of them we didn't have a chance to cover, second from the bottom. They also used one tier. The reason why they only used one tier is they didn't have time. They didn't want to spend a lot of time going through screening levels with default assumptions and then using site-specific information. They just wanted to take the numbers that the regulator gave them in the state of Washington and run with them. And in fact, they bolstered that single tier by using statistical criteria and doing statistical sampling. So they did a lot of interesting things. And they also, I should say, they used the triad approach too, which for those of you who might be familiar with it, is an expedited site assessment with a lot of flexibility. So they were very smart too, but it's interesting to see that, yeah, a single tier may not merely be the most simple approach, or it can be used in a complicated way to manage a project. Lastly, on slide 45, I want to show you some of the risk management decisions. We saw a range of things. To the limited excavation at the very first site, the Whitebridge, California site, but that was supported with higher analysis. To the Lust site, which was managed administratively with a detailed closure letter. The New Jersey site, where they demolished the site because they couldn't achieve it with the recurrent residents. And I'll just indicate these last two. I was saying a lot of good things about the Evergreen Washington site. They had a quick desire for reuse, and they also had an interest in managing soil in limited ways. And very last site, for those of you that are interested in community participation, this was one of the sites where there were residents currently living on the site, and their concerns were integrated into the risk assessment choices and recommendations that were made. In slide 46, in conclusion, risk assessment and risk management is a balancing act between the players, the iteration that takes place through the life cycle of the case, the data that are available, the communication that takes place, and the variation. And as Marty said, it's important to get everybody on board. The variation that you see in risk assessment practices are often due to programmatic preferences. If you're in the state of California or in my old state of Nevada, they just might approach regulation in very different ways. And sometimes there are honest technical differences of opinion. So the important thing is to be transparent and let everyone see why the decisions, what decisions were made and why. So with that, I'd like to turn the program over to Juliana.
Thank you, Bennett. On slide 47, we're going to take a break now for questions. For our simulcast participants, it's the orange question mark at the top of the slide that's going to allow you to send in questions. For the phone line audience, you're welcome to unmute your line and ask your own questions out loud. You need to unmute at your location. Select *6 to unmute the phone line. That's *6 to unmute using our system. And when you ask a question, please state the name and location that you're calling in from. Do we have questions to start from our phone line audience? We have simulcast questions from Yael Mason at the Israel Ministry of Environmental Protection in Tel Aviv. In the U.S., are all cleanup goals, and he refers to slide 15. So if you'd like to, along the left, there's a list of slide numbers. You can jump back to slide 15. In the USA, are all cleanup goals, slide 15, are nowadays a result of risk assessment or PRGs or non-risk assessment goals still used?
And I want to refer you back to our first ICRC risk document where we actually explored the various screening levels that are used by the states. And refer you back to that document to learn what the basis of all of those values. Some of them are risk-based, some are not. So.
And this is Bennett. If it's very possible to conduct a cleanup without considering exposure, without thinking about populations. It's almost like the sound of a tree falling in a forest. There are many project managers who are very focused on chemical concentrations, and they never ask the question of whether or not anyone is exposed. What's the probability of exposure? So your answer would be, no, they are not all risk-based.
We have a second question. Does EPA and federal and state levels always allow risk assessment to take place, or in some cases, are more conservative cleanup goals required?
This is Bennett. I would go with the technical expertise of regulatory agencies. There are some state regulatory agencies that don't have risk assessors, and they are less familiar with that. So they might encourage other approaches. You know, they might encourage excavation. It's simple and easy, and it doesn't involve the cost being placed into that. They rather put it into excavation. An actual cleanup.
Yael Mason of the Israel Ministry of Environmental Protection also asks, what are the requirements for risk assessors for Tier 1 and for the higher tiers? What criteria are required from the consultant company, from the assessment team, as far as education and hands-on experience?
I'll at least point out in a tier three, and I went through that quickly and, you know, basically assumed that people understood what a probabilistic risk assessment is. That involves, a team of people that are able to handle a probability distribution of risks, rather than working with a single point estimate of risk assessment. So it involves some higher mathematical processing and skills. You'd also need the way to handle those data, so additional data management considerations that not all consulting firms might have. And then stepping back to tier two, it requires going out and sampling at the site and whether there is a sampling plan in place or whether that there's personnel to go out and do that, or again, the appetite. It might just be an issue of timing of it's Christmas and it's difficult to get a team out to sample. That might affect some of the decision making that's being made.
Do we have questions from our phone line audience? Remember to unmute your line, both at your location, and *6 to unmute using our system. As a reminder, on the last slide, we have a link to our feedback form. So if you leave before we wrap up today, please go ahead and go to the last slide, select that feedback form, and give us your feedback. We use the information and really appreciate you taking a little bit of time before you leave the website to give us your feedback. We'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break and move on with the second half of our training, and we'll get to more questions, I hope, in the next question and answer break. But for now, let's move on to the second half of our presentation. If you move to slide 48, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Janine Hanley of the Arizona DEQ.
Thanks, Juliana. I'd like to start out Module 3 by kind of reflecting on the kind of the conclusions that Bennett had mentioned about each of the individual sites that were actual sites. And as you noticed, they occurred in different states, which means different regulatory context of which that happened. And so if you think about your own state or the states that you've worked in or are familiar with, you might think about how that outcome might be different in your particular situation or experience. And so basically, you know, if we could have picked up any one of those sites and moved it to the different regulatory venues that are available throughout the United States, what kind of answers would we see? You know, what would differ, what factors would be different in the risk assessment, whether it be regulatory or technical, and then how would those outcomes be as far as risk management decisions or remediation requirements. And so in order to be able to kind of do that without actually picking a site up and moving it, what we did was we basically took some case studies to look forward into a standard pattern, a standard set of data, and apply it to various regulatory contexts. And because we had different participants from the states available to evaluate these cases and give their answers, this was a learning experience where we found some surprising indications on really what matters and what doesn't in the outcomes on your sites. So to move to slide number 49, I'd like to kind of indicate what we are going to be looking at here in Module 3. Is what we want to get out of here is that we're going to take a look at how the different regulatory contexts, and by regulatory context, it could either be state-specific, or sometimes there's different agencies within a state, and then there's also different programs within a particular agency. So all those are going to be separate contexts or venues as we talk about that as we go through this module. So based upon that particular setting, we're going to look at how the regulatory and technical guidance and policies that are available there influence these particular criteria that we have set up in this particular site. So we're going to look at what happens. What are the variations that happen in our numerical risk-based cleanup criteria? What causes differences in sampling activities in our data use that we collect from the sites? And then what impacts our risk assessment practices and our risk management options and how that happens. What are the driving factors for why there are differences or why there are similarities? Moving to slide 50, I'd like to introduce to you basically what our comparative studies look like. They're hypothetical in nature. because certain factors were simplified in order to keep a learning experience available out of this. And we'll have two different hypothetical sites. One of them involved only one contaminant, while the other involved three. But it was also important to note that we used real data sets. We wanted to keep out any bias from any of the participants influencing our answers that we got out of it. And we also tried to keep it simple by limiting it to soil contamination within a narrow zone. That way we eliminated a lot of factors regarding leaching and plant, edible plant take-up and such like that. So using standardized questionnaires, everyone responded with their responses, and then we kind of did a breakdown and analysis of what those responses were and why. And so in the end, when all of our goals with sites are to, you know, you got to characterize them, you got to evaluate whether that contamination is good enough as is or whether it needs to go further. And in the very end, our goal is to see what needs remediation and what doesn't. And if we don't have to remediate, are there other options that can get us to done? Because that's what we all want to achieve is site closures. On slide 50, I'm going to introduce to you our participants in our first case study. And so we had a large variety of people. They all have their various regulatory requirements and their technical guidance, and so I'll refer you back to our overview document for specific discussions on those because they can vary quite a bit, and they will be important and impact what you do with your site. On slide 52, I'm going to introduce the first case study that we did. As you can see from the diagram there on the slide, we have a particular plot of land that is 1.2 acres, and you can see individual dots or locations with sample numbers on those. Those are the locations at which soil samples were actually collected, and there's 77 points in total. Now, this was a former skeet range, and it is proposed for development into six lots. And as you can see, each lot is designated A through F, and this will be a residential neighborhood specifically. So what they did at each of those locations, they sampled a soil sample from the 0 to 6 inch interval. They collected another soil sample at each location from 6 to 12 inches. So for every site, you have two samples. Now, on some locations, there was a third sample that was taken at 2 feet below the surface. So it's not across the board. Everyone had a three sample set off of each location. They're all analyzed again. Because of the skeet rain, the chemical of concern was lead, and it was all analyzed by the same analytical methods. So we ended up with a data set here of 170 data points. And as you can see, there's a proposed residential layout here. Again, we eliminated leachability as a concern because that would be a complicating factor. And we were asked, all the participants were asked to answer certain questions and to help us identify what criteria are impacted by different risk assessment regulatory venues. So in slide 53, as all of you have probably experienced, every site has a life cycle as far as its development from the initial identification of contamination all the way through site closure. And so at these particular stages in the life cycle of a site is depicted in the leftmost column. And each state was asked to identify what numerical criterion do you use at each cycle in the life cycle of the site that would be applied at that particular time. And you can see that in the preliminary investigation stage that everybody uses a default criterion. So, but not everybody uses exactly the same number. And we found that on the right, we had various numbers that were used. So the least being 75 mg per kilogram of lead, and the greatest being 400 mg per kilogram of lead. And a majority of people actually use the 400, but this is an important point where how your site ends up will depend upon what numerical criteria is applied for your site's evaluation. Now, the point of departure then begins with your further, more remedial investigation. And those site-specific criteria can be applied either depends on the state or the regulatory program. It could be a site-specific risk assessment that's applied, or it could be the EPA's default lead model for the adults. And some states actually have a site-specific lab model that they elect to use. So you can use site-specific values with those various methodologies to actually establish a site-specific criterion to apply to your site. So these are, again, this is relatively simple because it applies to lead only, but it does very much impact decisions and the evaluation that happens at the site later on, as we'll see in the next slide. So in slide 54, we asked them, given all this data, how do you go about evaluating it? And one of the first questions we asked was, how do you handle each of these proposed lots? And that wasn't necessarily a unanimous decision. Depends upon the agency's regulations. You first need to check there if they have specific regulations with regard to whether it's a legal basis or property boundary or whether it's based upon a single source for the source of contamination or multiple sources. It would, the exposure unit and the lots can be quite different. It's occasionally, you know, there are some regulatory programs that will allow the entire area itself that would include all six lots to be evaluated together, where there would be some individual breaking up with other regulatory context. So that's an important point, which reflects, therefore, on what data points are used. So if you can evaluate more than one exposure unit or more than one lot, or whether it's grouped all together, that therefore evaluates what data points are grouped together. And when you start grouping them together, we ask them, how do you go about doing that? Do you do it horizontally? Do you do it vertically? Do you average? And typically, everybody does allow for some form of averaging, although there was one particular regulatory program that said there's absolutely no averaging going on. Each and every point is its own entity and will be treated that way. So, however, in most cases, you do allow for some form of averaging, and it sometimes, depending on the state, or the program is going to be adjusted by what they define as the zone that's applicable. So the applicable zone, therefore, rolls over into what we see as the definition between shallow versus subsurface soils. So and everybody does a difference between that. We found that out. However, how that's defined is not always clear, or it's very well set in a very defined zone. Everybody includes 0 to 6 inches, for sure. However, when it goes beyond that, that's where some of the variability comes in. Some people allow up to 15 feet because that would therefore care for future uses and excavation that soils could be brought up to the surface. So in the end, though, your subsurface or deeper soils, basically the point of departure starts with where you end the shallow soil, and then it goes all the way down to where the groundwater table is. So again, how you define your soil zones will affect how your data is grouped. So the other impact to data use would be, are any of these points allowed to be composited and have it instead of segregate samples, have composite samples represent the exposures and the chemical concentrations? And we found that in some cases, yes, you can. In other cases, no. That's going to be a very programmatic and site-specific thing, sometimes a state-specific thing. So that is a very important point to look at. Now, compositing should not be confused with multi-incremental samples or incremental sampling methodology. In the future, the ITRC will be presenting a course on this and a guidance document for this particular methodology. But keep in mind that composite sampling, in many cases, is not the same, and it cannot be used the same. And in fact, by most sites, most states, it's kind of discouraged when it comes to risk assessment. The last implication then was, how do you handle duplicates when they're taken in the field? And there were some duplicates, as most sites tend to have as part of quality control. And this is very different. Again, some states will treat each sample as a separate entity and a separate data point. However, some states will actually average those two, the duplicates, and then represent that with the single point being the average. In other places, they will take the highest of the two values, or in some places they just look at it as this is a means of evaluating the laboratory's quality assurance, and we won't actually use that second duplicate sample unless, of course, it indicates a hotspot issue. So again, these types of practices are can vary quite a bit, and we'll see how that affects your exposure point concentrations, which in the end is what it's all about when you compare what your site has for a concentration to what your regulatory cleanup criterion is going to be. So in slide 55, we're going to take a look now at how all that data was used and lumped together or manipulated or calculated or segregated into what they determine an exposure point concentration to be. Now, keep in mind, not every program or state will allow a calculation for an exposure point concentration because each data point had to be treated separately. But in the most part, everyone, a large majority of programs do. But you can see with this graph, this represents the responses for the calculated level of exposure point concentration for lead. And there's quite a bit of variability. It's curious that states 5 and 6 actually ended up using the same methodology. So they came up with identical answers. So that was of interest. In other cases, we could see that, for instance, states 1, 2, and 3, they were able to calculate only one exposure point concentration per lot. And that was their particular regulatory requirements that caused them to be able to do that. There was, in one case, for state number 2, which is in the kind of the red candy cane, the exposure point concentration is identical between each of the lots, which was kind of a unique feature. In other states, though, you can see where there are sometimes 2 or even 3 exposure point concentrations calculated within a lot. And again, this goes back to what they consider the appropriate soil interval and how they define that. So it's quite interesting to see all the different outcomes that can happen. And I'll give you an example. On lot D, if you take a look at that particular lot, there's that exhibits probably one of the greatest variability in exposure point concentrations that ended up getting calculated here. The highest concentration was 857 mg per kilogram. Now, if you were to move that site to a different regulatory venue, the lowest value that ended up coming out of it was 116 mg per kilogram. So you can see that has quite an impact there. And it just the way this particular evaluation turned out is we ended up less than a 10, you know, one order of magnitude differences between states. So some of the differences were insignificant, and some of them were a little bit more than sevenfold difference. So in slide 56, we kind of took a look at, well, why did the exposure point concentration, what did we learn from that when we did that exercise? And we found that, okay, it makes a big difference if every if the data is grouped together or if it's distinguished individually as a standalone point. But a lot of people will calculate a 95% UCL. So there is a difference in software packages available, so that might be a difference in your outcome on your 95% UCL. Some states and regulatory programs will actually, instead of doing a 95% UCL, will accept the simple average. And that, again, is a difference. But almost everybody pulls the data together, but you have to understand whether it's pulled by lot or whether it's pulled by soil interval, because that makes a big difference in your exposure point concentration. So in the last step of this evaluation, this case study, we took it to the last phase, which is managing it for closure. What are your risk management options here? So in slide 57, we'll begin with looking at what the different participants designated as areas that needed further attention, either further attention in some form, whether it required active remediation or not. And the state on the left, they indicated that nothing needed to be remediated. So, you know, if you have that particular site in that particular state, you would benefit by cost savings there. However, not all the other participants had that particular outcome. As you can see on the right, the entire lot B, would needed to be remediated by either excavation or other management outcome. In slide 58, we have two other regulatory results. On the left, you'll see contiguous areas that were slated for remedial or risk management needs with a kind of a little zone of clean in between the bigger area and then a smaller little hatched area below that. So It was not drawn by individual lots or individual areas. as opposed to what they did on the right. On the right, that particular regulatory participant actually designated zones where they measured out areas that were clean enough around it. And so using that delineation method, instead of having a contiguous field to remediate, you have actual, tends to be hotspot areas to evaluate and remediate. In slide 59, lastly, our other regulatory entity actually broke it up into soil intervals. And you'll notice the 0 to 6 inch interval has a very, very large aerial footprint that needs remedial management. And they took index to the remedial requirements that were going to be needed between the 6 to 12 inches. And you can see they're not contiguous, and they're almost in a hotspot area, again, defined by areas of clean between certain sampling locations. So keeping in mind, excavation is not the only only way to manage the risk here. So in slide 60, when we asked them about what are your other options available besides excavation, basically what we learned was that you could actually more closely define your statistical exposure point concentration by excavating those zones and then resampling. And those new sample confirmation points would then substitute into your data set to reevaluate your exposure point concentration. And then once you get to a point that's below your cleanup criteria, then you're done. Okay, now other places allowed such things as being able to put a cap over those particular areas of concern. And that would have to be implemented simultaneously with an institutional control in order to make sure that that cap did not get degraded or moved or removed in any means. Other places said that, you know, if you wanted to look at other aspects, you would have to conduct additional delineation. You would need a greater number of sample sets. And then with that sample set, we would decide what available options would be to either remediate less or the means of remediation. Other places allowed the areas of concern to be relocated under buildings. So you could actually work with a contractor who's developing the area to situate structures, permanent structures, over areas that were not going to be profiled for excavation. And then lastly, there was a requirement in some cases where you would actually need to get rid of the source materials that remained there, i.e. the lead pellets that were the source of lead from the seed chute. That would actually have to be cared for as well. So just to summarize what we've learned from this first prospective study, we'll take a look at slide 61. And basically, our points here are that your regulatory context has a lot of impact, whether it's written in rules or it's technical guidance. Either of those, whether it's regulations or technical, your exposure point concentration is an important criteria that has a lot of variability built into it. And then when your numerical criteria is compared to that, then we add another layer of variability, which then drives whether or not we need to remediate or have a risk management issue. Now, some of the particular caveats that might be associated with the site is that this actually did not get developed yet. This is proposed for developed. So by the time they're done developing it, you might actually have some additional or some fewer concerns in your risk management options. So, again, that depends very much on your regulatory context, what needs to be considered. In slide 62, then, we decided to introduce a second case study, and again, this was to kind of eliminate some of the regulatory, handcuffs that you can say particular programs and agencies have. And if we were able to take those off the table, then what additional information would we see as far as factors which have some variability in it and impact our risk management decisions? So basically, to eliminate that, in our second case study, we took away the variability of what numerical criterion you could use to compare your site to. So everybody has a set, uniform, fixed numerical criteria to use. This particular case study also had fixed lot sizes and fixed boundaries that are already pre-existing, so there was no concern over whether or not the boundaries would move or whether or not the use on them would move. This particular case study number two had very well-defined and existing residential, commercial, or in one lot, it was a school that was present. In this case, we already, in case two, we already had our structures already built. Land use was determined, and we introduced here the concept of a fixed background. And this is naturally occurring background that's evaluated here. And we wanted to see what impact in the risk assessment process or risk management decisions background actually plays. So, again, we're fixing this to superficial soils. We don't allow them to have a regulatory or technical pre-deciding criteria of what zone it is, whether it's 0 to 6 or 0 to 12. We set it as a uniform playing field there. So we have basically in this particular case, I'll explain a little bit more about the context here of how this looks in the coming up slides here. But our case number 2 on slide 63 had a fewer number of participants, but the one of the participants was actually an end user instead of a regulatory entity. It was represented by the Department of Defense, which they typically end up being the end users of the risk assessment. They have both EPA requirements in their, within their region that they're required to follow, as well as some state regulatory requirements. And there were three entities, I believe it was the Army, the Air Force, and Navy, that participated in those responses for this case study. So in slide 64, what I'm going to do is give you an example of what these lots look like. Now, again, there's a total of 9 lots here, so it's much too much for us to be able to represent in this particular presentation. But to succinctly describe what happens here is everybody was given maps of each of the lots, and as you can see, the sampling locations are designated for them, and all the data sampling results were given for each of those lots. And you can see the location of the structures are all provided, as well as the boundaries of them. And so this particular community had all contiguous lots, 1 through 9. Again, all the contamination is limited to superficial soil, and they were told that your contaminants of concern are arsenic, copper, and lead. So we have 3 contaminants here. And that's so we can look at a little bit more of that risk assessment practice. They were also told that all 3 contaminants are distributed throughout this pre-existing community, and that the contamination actually occurred by a couple different means of migration, but it all happened at the same time. So this migration occurred by deposition from precipitation events, pulling down the suspended particles. It also occurred by surface water runoff over the area, and it also occurred by any of the airborne particulates as they settled out. They were settling out over the entire area. And then, of course, you know, you have human trafficking in and between these areas, so that it, again, contributed somewhat to some of the migration or moving of the contaminants. Each lot is, they were told, were a half acre, which is, in some cases, a little bit bigger than what you see in urban areas. Lot 7, however, is unique in that it's a school, and it was a three-quarter acre lot with a little bit bigger area and obviously very different uses going on at a school than it would otherwise at a residential or a commercial area. So in slide 65, what we're going to do is start looking at what the different approaches were for the data and what were their data needs. And the first thing we started out again, as before in the other case study, was how do you define your exposure unit? And largely, everybody used the individual lot here as the exposure unit, and largely because it was already predefined. There is, in very few cases, where this would vary. But your exposure unit is basically what drives the data grouping for exposure point concentration. They were asked about composites. And unlike in the first example where they might they're typically not allowed, but in some cases are. They were not, by a majority, not considered here because they considered the sampling density to be sufficient that it wouldn't require composites. But that, again, is something you should check with your regulatory program, is in certain instances that might be considered. Again, if you look at the little lot number, not everybody has the density or the number of samples per exposure unit sufficient to go forward in a risk assessment. In this particular case, we did, so this is a unique feature that you may not experience on your actual sites. And you can see by each lot that's designated, the number of samples N are given. And you can see that they ran as high as number of 52 samples taken from the school, all the way down to 14 in lot number one. They were asked, you know, what would drive any further data acquisition for them? And some of the things that would possibly you might need to consider as well are if there's a difference in land use across a boundary, perhaps you need to delineate further because the residential criteria are going to be a little bit more stringent than a commercial criteria. The other cases were the location concentrations might exceed background or screening level, but they would like to see additional sampling around that particular area. So those are things to keep in mind when you get your data support. In slide 66, I'd like to continue on with our first step in initial screening. And we all know that sites have to go through this. So they were given predetermined screening levels, not ones that they have in their regulations. So given in this particular chart, you can see what the screening levels were, and they're quite different for residential versus commercial. And the naturally occurring background was given for each of the three contaminants. So, again, sometimes, as Bennett pointed out, background is considered and sometimes it is not, and this will be interesting to see how this develops. But largely, when they do the screening, initial screening, they tend to use the maximum concentration. And this is a pretty ubiquitous practice. And there typically is not a whole lot of deviation from that. But in the cases where it is, there are examples noted below this particular table where the 95% UCL might be used for either lead or arsenic, or you could use the average as well for lead in some particular cases. Now, one particular state actually has different criteria if you are either less than or greater than three times the screening level. So that's something to keep in mind, which is does not necessarily occur in all regulatory contexts. In slide 67, I'd like to show you that despite the fact that we had exactly identical screening levels and most people were using the maximum concentration, we actually see different results on what chemicals failed for what lots. So this particular slide here indicates the lots that failed the initial screening. And, for example, there are two particular groups, groups A and C, had identical results. All lots, 1 through 9, failed for all three contaminants. But that wasn't the case for the other groups that evaluated necessarily. And the reason why ended up being the fact whether or not they used a residential screening level or a commercial screening level. So again, even your initial screening can be affected by whether or not they allow a more stringent residential or the actual use of commercial being included. In slide 68, we asked about how do you go about evaluating your exposure point concentration. And granted, they have all exactly the same identical data set, and they're all using the same lots as exposure unit. Everybody uses the 95% UCO, and that's because there's an adequate number of samples here. There is an example, and I'll refer you back for details in our overview document, of when the exposure point concentration is not the 95% UCO. And that has to do with copper and lead. So you might keep that in mind on sites where you have those two contaminants. In slide 69, they were given the option of the next level of screening, whether or not they would accept that or not. And at this particular point, they were asked, can a risk assessment be used? And everybody said, absolutely, you can use a risk assessment. However, the question was, can you use that risk assessment to back calculate a secondary, more site-specific screening level rather than the generic predetermined one? Now, not everybody agrees on that particular step. So, again, this makes a big difference on your site. So for those sites that did allow screening, you can see that the secondary screening values are higher and that in some cases, some of the particular contaminants will drop out of a lot. Now, This makes a big difference then if you screen certain chemicals out on certain lots, what your cumulative risk is going to be and what your cumulative risk management decisions are going to end up focusing on. So in slide 70, let's take a look at what those numbers turned out to be. When they went forward into the risk assessment mode, And again, this is whether or not something got screened out in the preliminary screening or whether or not the secondary screening was allowed to take something off. You can see how this impacts your excess lifetime cancer risk. So I'll point out for lot number 7, this particular lot, again, this is the school. One group did not calculate the excess lifetime cancer risk because they specifically wanted to evaluate site-specific conditions, which were not provided within the study. So that's why they did not particularly contribute a value. But you can see we have some of the variation here. These are the ranges now for each lot. It might be just due to rounding, and in other cases it was due to the screening practices that they have. It can vary up to one order of magnitude, as you can see. In some cases, it's not very significant at all. Same thing is reflected with the hazard index in slide 71. You can see the variation in the range that was calculated for the hazard index on each of the lots. Again, some cases not very much. Might be due to rounding. Other cases had everything to do with their screening practices in the primary or secondary, whether it was done or not. So, again, this was a good tool for us to see why you end up with different results with exactly the same site. So in slide 72, I'd like to try to summarize some of the risk approaches there that might add another layer of consideration into your site. And what we found out was that, when it comes to lead, it's always pretty much considered separately from other contaminants. However, they were given as an exercise that there is existing data out there that supports the additive effects of arsenic with lead, and that given sufficient guidance from the feds, would you actually incorporate the arsenic with the lead for cumulative or additive effects? In most states, this particular regulatory programs would not. They would look at it more as a qualitative evaluation for risk management, but they would certainly not use that in a quantitative means at this particular point in time. And that's largely because there probably isn't enough established practice and guidance on that. We also found out that it also varies whether or not arsenic is evaluated for its non-carcinogenic effects. As you all know, arsenic is both a carcinogen as well as a non-carcinogen. That happens with other chemicals that were not evaluated, for example, benzene. You will see in some states, because the driver is going to be the carcinogenic properties, they may not look at the non-carcinogenic contribution, while other states will in their cumulative risk evaluation. And lastly, for the background metals, this is something that tends to be highly variable between regulatory programs. And most programs will not quantify it as part of the final risk estimate, whether it be a standalone or combined with incremental risk. A lot of places will look at it as a consideration for risk management. But again, this tends to be highly variable, and we all know that metals tend to be naturally occurring, and arsenic has been, for many sites, kind of an issue in some cases. Your schools are going to be your other places where you're going to have a lot of variability, and some of that variability is driven by whether that particular regulatory program uses the child lead model, or whether or not they implemented just as a generic residential, same as any other dwelling and home that they apply a risk assessment to. There also are states that have developed very specific child exposure factors for the school scenario. So, again, you need to look at what they have developed and how far along they are in very site-specific or regulatory requirements in the risk assessment. So, now that we've kind of looked at both of these cases and we've looked at, summarized what the regulatory requirements are, what they have in common and what they don't, let's kind of sum up what we learned in our second case study. On slide 73, the major points were that everybody agreed that using a site-specific risk assessment will afford you different risk management options, including different forms of remediation. As opposed to cleaning up to your very default predetermined cleanup criterion. So again, that might be a cost savings as well as your risk management options that are available to you. And some of those particular variability of what those options are depends here in this particular case on what the actual owners of the property are desire for their own endpoints. What level of risk are they willing to accept? What areas are they willing to have remediation done versus not done on? And whether or not there's any site-specific uses that occur within a particular lot that might be different, might be also considered. We found that basically here, there's not a whole lot of technical variation between the risk assessment practices once you get the regulatory-specific stuff off the table. And so that's kind of good to know that. But we found that when there's variations that occur, sometimes a lot of what drives that is the lack of guidance that's established and lack of practice with regard to how to deal with that particular criteria. So just to sum up then what we learned from our case studies, I'll direct you to slide 74, that you know, it's important that your regulated entities as well, that would be in your end users and all your stakeholders, and the people that are trying to practice good, sound science, that all plays out into what your regulatory or your risk management options are going to be in your decisions. Now, many of the factors are going to be regulatory dependent. Right out from the get-go, out of the box, you need to find out what those are, and those will definitely direct your course. However, the risk assessment, the science of risk assessment is then applied at that point. There's not a whole lot of variation on there. So we find that, you know, your biggest criteria that are going to impact your sites are going to be how you determine your exposure unit, how you use your data, how you group them, and then how you use that to evaluate and calculate your exposure point concentration, and whether or not your background is considered. And lastly, your regulatory cleanup level, you know, that might vary, but once you get out of that default number, you can then apply a site-specific one throughout the rest of your life cycle. So how this affects the approach and development in various regulatory communities is actually going to be discussed in Module 4, and I'll turn that back over to Bennett.
Thanks, Janine. On slide 75, I'd like us all to start with this final module, in which I'm going to provide the perspective, summary, and recommendations from the team and try to pull together all the different strains of thought that the team has been thinking about over the years and what we learned, again, from this retrospective look and a prospective look at how regulators and project managers are managing risk at sites. On slide 76, I'd like to point out, because of the importance of the overview document, I'd like to cross-reference the learning objectives of this module with relevant portions of the document. Perspectives from the risk resources team members are captured in Chapter 6 of the document. And then in Chapter 7, there are key findings from the team's process review, the case studies detailed in the previous modules of the training, and perspectives mentioned above, and you can also see some of those perspectives in Chapter 4 and 5 of the document. The second part of Chapter 7 outlines the team's recommendations and also results in a proposed improved process of using risk assessment in the management of contaminated sites. While the proposal may seem to be ideal, the team nevertheless concluded that implementation of many or most of the key process recommendations will yield better management results with less variation across regulatory programs, a more predictable product for your projects. On slide 77, let's say that we convinced you to work towards improving the way you, your agency, or firm do business and integrating risk assessment into the management of contaminated sites. We'll have to warn you there are going to be some roadblocks. So moving upward through this diagram, as you're imagining you're on the road, all regulators, stakeholders, and end users on the team noted that regulators are probably the first roadblock you're going to hit because they may lack technical expertise. Regulators also don't do a great job of making processes transparent or issuing clear guidance that Janine just pointed out. And lastly, the end users and stakeholders, they may be slow to accept the process and any of these changes that you propose to it. But we are pretty adamant that if you do, you are going to get an improved process. On slide 78, we show the improved process that's presented in the Risk Assessment Resources Team Overview document, Use of Risk Assessment in Management of Contaminated Sites. In figure 7.2 of the document, we set it side by side with a summary of the classic process, which is on the left side. On the right side, again, you see that proposed improved process. I show you the whole deal right now, but I'm going to break apart that improved process into beginning, middle, and end so that you'll get a better look at it. But I'd just like you to look at the general outline of the process, and in particular the one on the right that the team believes will improve the use of risk assessment in risk management of sites. And broadly, you can see many more feedback loops in the improved process on the right to reflect the reality that while involving stakeholders early in the process might not be required, it anticipates their eventual involvement. And you have to keep checking back with them, and you have to keep checking with the regulators, especially if they don't have clear, transparent guidance already provided. But back to the stakeholders, if you don't involve them in the process, the process could be viewed as flawed, and they could make you go back and redo decision-making, which will lead to delays and increased costs. So the improved process uses an approach that addresses the needs of stakeholders and the needs of end users with valid science in a timely and cost-effective manner. On slide 79, in the next set of slides, I'm going to present key findings and their details in section 7.1 of the overview document. And these findings, among others, arose from the discussions of factors influencing variation in risk assessment in Chapter 3, which Marty discussed in the very first module. Note that these selected factors show the need to be aware of the sources of variation and develop systematic planning. And you can do that by using a conceptual site model that evolves as a common framework for working through the gaps between various parties' and scientific facts that they use and the values that they consider important to them. And that notion of there are facts and then there are things that people value or what we call the fact that, the separation between them, we call the fact-value gap. And you see that everywhere in disciplines that are cutting-edge sciences, frontier sciences, such as climate change. There are many facts about climate change. However, people have different values and different beliefs that they value in some cases more than the facts. You see it with H1N1 epidemiology, and you see it in risk management and use of risk assessment. Risk assessment is part of a cutting edge science and approach to managing contaminants in the environment. As far as risk assessment, that fact value gap often occurs between the scientific facts used in risk assessment and the values embraced by stakeholders, as well as regulators making decisions and taking actions under particular legal and regulatory frameworks. So the improved framework we recommend can help shrink this gap between the scientific facts and the values that people possess, even scientists and engineers, simply by getting everybody in the same room, on the same page, and to document what they agree upon. As I note in the slide, be careful in assuming that simplifying complex problems with tier values or less flexibility will improve the process. Then everybody starts questioning, well, where'd you get those numbers? And again, climate change is excellent. It's an excellent case study in the problem of public acceptance of scientific fact, and I would just assume the same hold for risk assessment and the risk assessment and risk management project you may have to address. On slide 80, the second set of key findings I highlighted module 2 today, and it's further detailed in chapter 4 of the overview document. That's where the five case studies demonstrated that the amount of risk assessment used is not necessarily proportional to the value added. For example, using statistical approaches rather than bright lines or not succeed criteria can reduce the volume of soil requiring treatment. That was that last site, the Evergreen Washington cleanup of a military base that I pointed out, hey, they only had one tier, but they, again, were able to do additional work. Sometimes field methods can result in more data in real time and reduce costs and increasing the characterization confidence and increasing accuracy of hotspot delineation. That was at that White Bridge, California fruit orchard. Single discrete samples can be an oversimplification that creates, in some cases, solves some problems, and we saw that at that Lust site in Wisconsin. It's important to evaluate early on the objectives and decisions involved and to do so in a systematic fashion. So you establish the kind, quality, and quantity of data required and then move forward with flexibility and being willing to revise, to iterate, and update the approach according to lessons learned from the growing project database. 81. A third set of key findings arose from the prospective comparative case study discussed by Janine in Module 3. And they emphasize the importance of clarity and transparency in systematic planning. The most critical is how the exposure unit is correlated to site characterization and the risk management decision-making. Every state cleanup program faces the same questions and same problems, and the risk assessment, risk management paradigm is offered as an appropriate path to answer those questions and to tackle these problems in a logical manner. But regardless of the approach, there are always questions of what to sample for, how to sample, how to process and interpret the results, and how to respond. And so the use of case studies allowed us to see this play out in a real-world setting. Many of the questions inherent in waste site cleanup draw a range of answers, and some are based on programmatic preferences of regulators, some that are due in response to the inherent uncertainty associated with site cleanup, and some due to lack of consensus about the best answer. Keeping in mind the entire presentation is based on simple sites, which we noted in Module 2 and 3, this report is only the start, a springboard for addressing fundamental questions at more complicated sites for which risk assessment professionals cannot yet provide confident answers. So if there are those of you that do have complicated sites, and what I mean are multiple chemicals or groundwater contamination, the improved process we recommend is likely to have even more value to you than at simple sites which involve less uncertainty and less money and less time invested to tackle the problems you find at the simple sites. Slide 82. I'd like you to note that the 8 recommendations that I present here are detailed in section 7.2 and figure 7.1 of the Risk Assessment Resources Team Overview document use of risk assessment in management of contaminated sites. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to discuss them here, but again, your goal is to shrink the gap between the scientific facts and the values that all of the players have and get everyone onto the same page. Slide 83. I'm going to present figure 7.2 again, and that's the proposed improved process for the use of risk assessment in the management of contaminated sites, and we're going to look at some of the details. And what I'll do is break the process on the right into three pieces, and let's start at the very beginning. On slide 84, you can see the start of the improved process, the first part of figure 7.2. That's on the right side. On the left side, down at the bottom, you can see the classic process. And it's very important that the remedial process and risk assessment begin with the end of the process in mind, that you have your goal that everyone is working towards. And the way to do that is with the conceptual site model. It's more than just a hypothesis about a contaminated site. It establishes a common framework. It's a concise and concrete depiction of the conditions being investigated. And it establishes the importance of issues deemed critical. And everybody agrees that they're critical for both the risk assessment and risk management decision. And it allows those involved, as well as skeptics, to define what the data gaps are that may exist. It's done early on in the process. And you should use language where you can easily communicate to lay people. And the term CSM may not be the best way to do that. Maybe you should simply call it the picture of the site or the story of the site. That risk communication should be practiced throughout. You want to keep all of the players, all the stakeholders, moving along with you as you learn more about the site and propose and make management decisions. Whoever is leading the remedial process needs to begin with those early engagements with everyone, and dialogue is important to appreciate each other's positions, get everyone to have an overlapping understanding, and in the end, end up with a fair process of engagement, explanation, and everyone's expectations. On slide 85, you can see the middle section, the middle steps of the improved process, depicted in figure 7.2, the overview. And from the preceding discussion, it should be clear that it takes a team that effectively communicates and is committed to carefully weighing decisions in the light of the awareness described above to plan systematically. Note on the left in the classic process, site characterization is all by itself. It's alone. It even involves no risk assessor. And that will eventually become a problem when the risk assessor is asked for input. If the site characterization obtains insufficient data, like I pointed out at that LUST cleanup, to inform the risk assessment decision effectively, then risk assessors are forced to use overly conservative assumptions, and the responsible party can arguably pay a price for that, that they might have had more options, had fewer assumptions needed to be made. But if you take a look on the right, a risk assessor's input is systematically included, and ideally sufficient data should be collected to satisfy multiple data uses, including risk assessment. If you choose to limit data collection, the project team needs to document that and evaluate that decision in terms of their impact to the project and any potential need for risk assessment and risk management decision making. On slide 86, you can see the end of the improved process shown in figure 7.2. Risk assessors need to be aware of their ultimate audience to design their assessments accordingly and to communicate their assessments effectively. There's never complete data, So the assessors should address issues of data quality, accuracy, and precision, and discuss the implications of variability and uncertainty on the assessment findings and conclusions. Risk assessment is more than mere numbers because we have to explain it in terms reasonable to the audience and avoid jargon. Risk assessors and risk managers alike must recognize that they're involved in a fact-intensive business, but stakeholders and end users are value-driven. Thus, risk assessors and managers must wrestle with how to shrink the fact-value gap that exists. And we believe that applying the team's recommendation and the proposed improved process discussed during this module can help. And so this completes Module 4, our final module, and I'd like to turn the presentation to Juliana to see if we have any more time for any questions.
Thank you, Bennett. Before we get to questions, on slide 87, I do want to take you to the links page as well as the feedback form. If you're in the simulcast audience, you're welcome to go ahead and start sending in questions using the question mark button at the top of the slide. You're welcome to select either section of the slide, links to additional resources or feedback form. If you do choose to go to the links page, if you look to the left under the Clue and Sun, the third item listed takes you over to the feedback form. We are looking for everyone on the call today to fill out that feedback form, and we really appreciate your taking a few minutes to give us your feedback. Looking at the links page, the first item listed, download today's ITRC training, that's going to allow you to download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what's been on the slides, there's more information in the notes section of this downloaded version. Bennett mentioned a PowerPoint presentation that included all 5 case studies in Module 2, and the next 2 items are ways for you to download that presentation either in PowerPoint or in PDF format, whichever is better for you. Today's training introduced the document, Use of Risk Assessment in Management of Contaminated Sites, the RISC-2 document. The next link is going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of this document. Today's training introduced the document, and we do recommend that you review the document itself, as well as the first document from the ITRC risk team. Looking down the page, there's additional resources available for you, and this links page is going to continue to be available, so if you'd like to come back to the page and look through some of these resources, you're welcome to do that as well. We are out of time for today's training class, so we won't be able to get to questions. We do have a page that has remaining simulcast questions and answers from past ITRC classes. What we'll do is we'll just add our simulcast questions that we have left to that page, and you're welcome to send in questions, and we'll post them on the page and then let you know when answers are available. To wrap up today's class, I'd like to thank our instructors and our participants for joining us today. We appreciate you being on the call. Again, if you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. It's information we use and appreciate you all taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. For more information on ITRC, you can visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.